Blog Talk Radio.
Steve Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane.
No, it's Max, Darrow, and D-Bert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
You know, folks, it would make sense for me to change that intro, I think, after all this time. Max, our dear friend Max, is no longer involved with our program, so it makes sense for us to actually change this thing, and I assure you we will be doing that. Folks, welcome once again for this Sunday afternoon. This is D-Bert, a.k.a. the Afternerd. Welcome to yet another fascinating, funky, fiery edition of The Comic Shop, as presented by Afternerd Radio. This is the Double Duty, Double Mint Gum broadcast. We have The Comic Shop now. And, of course, we have Afternerd Radio at 7 p.m. We will be interviewing author-journalist Norman Kelly regarding hip-hop business, R&B business, as well as his books, Rhythm and Business and HNIC, Head Negro in Charge, believe it or not. A lot to talk about him. And also, of course, we'll try to fit in Gabby Douglas, her accomplishments as well as the controversy surrounding her. Really crazy stuff, folks. Anyway, The Comic Shop up first. Let's go into a quick, and I do mean quick, groove. In thinking about the Olympics, let's go to Team of the Year. Team of the Year, T-O-Y. We'll be back in a few moments. Hold on.
This is for the Great Lakes. This is for the fake hate. This is for the corn syrup dripping on our plates. This is for the farmland, car manufacturer that has to close down when the market lost its way. This is for those that eat steak with their meals. And this is for the other half trying to get a record deal. Who built the scene up? We had to have a team up. This is for the people who be smoking in the cornfield. This is for those who love wide open spaces. And this is for those who spent their winters in the basement. This is for those who watch Beat Street and taped it. And this is for those who didn't think we could make it. This is for Sheboygan, Wisconsin. This is for the projects of Michigan, this way of Compton. This is for those who forgot the Midwest can. Adam did it, man. Adam did it, man. Great Lakes Adventures, Midwest contenders for Team of the Year, just in case you don't remember. Feel the gravity that's pushing you down, cause we rise up, it's time for the Great Lakes to assemble. This is for John Burns, saw the tires burn up in Minnesota, cause the Twin Cities gotta learn. This is for Craig Hollis, who found out he can't die. This is for Dinosaur flying through the sky. And this is for Squirrel Girl. This is for Tippy Toe. This is for Gravity. This is for Monkey Joe. This is for Big Bertha, biggest Lake Ontario. This is for Adam Warrock playing in your stereo. This is for Grasshopper. This is for Flatman. This is for Deadpool and all teams in the damn land. This is for the OGs, Hawkeye and Mockingbird. This is for the mixtape, bound to rock the fucking world. This is for the Buckeyes. This is for the Libertine. This is for Red Dawn, yelling out Wolverine. This sex feeling in your chest.
The great Adam Warrock, Team of the Year, again, Adam Warrock, Team of the Year. Definitely check out his website for more comic book, sci-fi, fantasy-related rap. Okay, let's just get into it. I could not do it. I do this show without my team of the year. Of course, we're talking about the captain. Captain, let's come on in. You're needed on the bridge.
My hair has fixed and ready to go.
Oh, Jesus. That's not until the next broadcast, but I hear you. Okay, and of course, we could not do the show again without Daryl B. Let's just get into it.
Thoughts and prayers to the people in Wisconsin. This shooting stuff's got to stop, y'all.
Yeah, oh, man, forget it. Yes, about three people are dead in that shooting out there at a mosque, a Sikh mosque. Horrible stuff. All right, folks, once again, this is the Comic Shop. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. I want to keep it a bit simple today. We're going to take our cues from Daryl, as if we don't already, but more bluntly and more blatantly, we're going to take our cues from him. He has an excellent blog posting at afronerd.com. Again, definitely check out our blog that ties everything together, afronerd.com, his latest entry. And I figured we would just follow some of the topics that were brought up from Daryl B. Number one, Daryl, what are your thoughts on this Avengers TV deal? To our listening audience, we know that we have we're coming back from the Avengers movie blockbuster, $1.5 billion, and now the studio heads are talking about trying to extend that universe into a television property. What are your thoughts about that?
See, on the surface, this might seem like a good thing, but we've often talked about dilution of the products movie-wise by expanding. Wouldn't putting on a TV show with the Avengers dilute it even more? I look at it this way. I'm still waiting for the Hulk one. All right, we were promised that not showing up. The Alias, we were promised that. That hasn't showed up. Or the Jessica Jones, since we can't use Alias because, you know, J.J. Abrams beat us to that one, you know. Hey, Disney and Marvel, yo, you guys been slacking on the TV side here, you know. And it's not like there isn't a lot of properties that they could put on television. I don't see how doing a mini Avengers in the vein of Smallville is going to help when everybody's in love with the movie. You know, everybody's in love with Earth Mightiest Heroes. Isn't that going to dilute the product more? I'd rather do this. Make it into a S.H.I.E.L.D. series. That way it's connected to Avengers, but at the same time, you know, it's giving you the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. You know, it's giving you, get Maria Hill running S.H.I.E.L.D., all right? Get a task force or form a team, and they handle threats every week. Or, you know, something like that. But don't make an all-new Avengers freaking show. What the hell? Back to you, man.
Yeah, Captain, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it would seem that for the geeks in us that would love these properties, we'd love to see these things come to life. I'm a little bit reticent about this myself. I'm a little bit queasy about it, to be honest with you. What are your thoughts on the possibility of an Avengers-themed TV show?
Cash grab, and more cash grab. All right? We warned about this type of thing on this show. And the statements that are used are as follows. We say things such as, the money is dictating the art instead of the art dictating the money. So again, this equates to cash grab, and cash grab. Understand, I don't feel a TV series for the Avengers works at this given time. You understand, this is again the suits trying to just soak up with a big sponge all the liquid all at once. This is not good for geeks. I don't think this would be good for nerds at all. And it might even, you know, dilute, as Daryl says, the big cinema product. If you give too much, you can't have too much of a good thing. Someone give you some peach cobbler, you understand? Here's a little piece of pie. It's fine. If I start giving you 4 or 5 pieces of pot of of peach cobbler, now you don't want peach cobbler anymore. You have to be very careful. And just as Daryl says, there's other properties that they could use and they could bring to the TV screen. I think The Punisher would work very good on a TV series. I think that would work pretty good. You know, there's a lot of things they could do. But again, when you think the way the suits think, cash grab, cash grab, cash grab. Let's go with this now. It's hot. We can make money over the next 3 years. And after that, then everything is all burnt up. Cash and burn, you know, type of mentality. Back over to you, sir, Afro Nerd.
Yeah, you know, we're always about specificity here at Afro Nerd, at Afro Nerd / Comic Shop. And I'm looking at this link that Daryl B.A. Gain, folks, definitely go to his blog entry, latest blog entry at AfroNerd.com. But I'm looking at a link that he provided from our site to ComicsAlliance.com, again, ComicsAlliance.com. And just, let me just get into some specifics here because I think it's interesting. It says the article is entitled Marvel and ABC in Talks for a Possible Avengers Spinoff TV Show. With Guillermo del Toro's Hulk taking his time, and planned television's versions of The Punisher and Alias not being picked up by networks, there's a Marvel comic-shaped hole in network television right now. That's something that ABC and Marvel are said to be working on. However, with a live-action primetime spinoff of this summer's The Avengers movie apparently being discussed, Deadline broke the news over the weekend that Marvel TV, headed by Avengers X Sanction and Ultimatum scribe Jeff Loeb, and ABC, that's another issue. And ABC Studios are apparently having early discussions about what the site describes as a drama series in the Avengers world. The usual anonymous sources report that the series wouldn't be a direct spinoff of the movie. None of the characters from the record-breaking film would be likely to appear, apparently, something that's unsurprising when you consider their movie careers and resulting price tags, but would feature some of its themes and feel. See, I don't know. Now, it says, it goes even further. It says, amongst the ideas being discussed is a high-concept cop show, which may mean that Marvel's Bendis will have competition for his own creator-owned powers, a series with which has essentially the same high concept currently in the works at FX. Now, you know, they alluded to Alias, which I thought was a great idea. I didn't wince at that when they mentioned that about 2 years ago, and even The Punisher would work, especially, well, actually, you know what? As much as I wouldn't mind seeing a Punisher TV series, I mean, that would make a lot of sense. We see that there was a recent, I wouldn't even call it a trailer, a short film, like we talked about last show, with the original Punisher, well, the second original Punisher. You know, not Dolph Lundgren. Who was the second guy? I'm sorry.
Thomas Jane.
Yeah, Thomas Jane. And it was that was The Punisher. It took so long, Darryl, why? Humor me. Why does it take so long to get to the obvious? This is the way Punisher should have been done. Now, even the first one, folks, when they had him in Miami, they had John Travolta there. It still had a touch of the campiness in it. It was a touch of the campiness. But the one that was done for, I don't know, $50 and a nickel, you know, on a budget that was done for YouTube, was what I – that's The Punisher. I mean, Thomas Jane definitely loves the character. I would like to see him – really see him as The Punisher. Just that the film that he was in just didn't make any sense. Why does it take so long to get to the point of the obvious?
Because they overthink everything. They overthink everything, and then they plan it, and then, oh, shoot, we're over budget, and then there's too many fingers in the pot, too many cooks in the kitchen. The vision gets freaked. Well, that's my second. I got to say diluted, but it gets stretched out to the point where the original vision is lost. Now, I will surprise you folks, right? I will tell you how we can actually make the Avengers thing work on TV, and people won't understand it. But here it goes. You focus on the other Avengers. There's 200, 250 Avengers all around the world or whatever, right? If you make it like a global frequency type thing, where here are these heroes coming into their own, and you focus on different actors with either S.H.I.E.L.D. Keeping tabs on them, or they're coming into their own powers and stuff, and you focus on these guys and gals who have powers, have abilities, if you focus on that every week, and then just use whichever ones are the most popular, will get slots in the next Avengers movie. You know, you could focus on Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, and they're starting to get disillusioned after years of battling the X-Men, all right? Or you could focus on Ultron with creating the Vision, all right? You could focus on, well, we can't use Hank Pym for Ant-Man, but you could focus on Scott Lang. You could do that. You could do the Wasp. You could do, you know, but here it is. When they say Avengers, these guys have it stuck in their mind. Oh, we need Iron Man. We need Hulk. We need Captain America. We need Thor. Those are the Avengers. Black Widow. Yeah, Hawkeye. Yeah, those are the Avengers. And it's like, you know, it's stuck in the mud thinking. And like the Cap says, every time they're getting stuck in the mud thinking, you know, two words leap to mind: cash grab. And then three words: bleed franchise dry.
Well, you know something? I'm beginning to think this out a little bit better the more that you're talking about it. A lot of what you said is correct. I mean, I just think if they're going to do it, if they need to do this, because you are talking about Disney buying 5,000 intellectual property properties. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, a lot of characters that they bought in the Marvel deal. Now, if they were to be smart about it, if they were to be smart, and this is where there's going to be an issue, many of these properties have been signed up for quasi-movie deals. But if you think about a TV show in this Avengers universe without really, you know, you might reference the, which is what they're going to have to do. They're going to have to reference the big Avengers, reference them. But have a Daily Bugle as a centerpiece of the show. Have an NYPD as the centerpiece of the show, an NYPD in the Marvel universe. That might actually work. You know, for whatever reason, they can on a whim, Daryl and Captain, on a whim, they can come up with this Avengers TV thing, and we still can't seem to get a black man from Wakanda to be made.
I knew it would eventually turn back around to this, you know, but the vehicle, the way we just described it, would be a perfect way to introduce the Black Panther. It would, you know, have him run across another hero or something like that, you know, but, you know, we're using something that Hollywood doesn't like to do. We're actually thinking this out.
We can't have Danny Rand and Luke Cage with an actual Hero for Hire storefront in Harlem and Misty Stone. I mean, that is TV gold, actually. That whole concept. I mean, if you really think about it, and have their stories, I mean, this has got to be a 2 or 3 year deal. Have their stories hint at some of what might be seen in the movie. That's if they're going to do it that way. You know, Doctor Strange has been written up, has been written up already for a movie. You know, we might not see it for another 6 or 7 years. But having a Doctor Strange in TV with his mansion in the village, his ornate weird mansion, or actually has a spell where it looks like one thing to some people. I mean, we've seen Charmed on TV already. So in essence, a Doctor Strange type of TV show would operate pretty much like that, but in a Marvel universe. And then it would be connective tissue for the movies. Now, if they're going to do this, we got to start writing some letters and demanding some checks, Daryl and Captain. Because this conversation right here would be a pitch meeting.
Or even this. You bounce around. if it's going to be on ABC Family, think about the teenage groups of heroes that we've had. We've had the Runaways, the original New Warriors. You know, you got the Young Avengers. Hell, X-Force, New Mutants, anyone? You know, it's just these guys don't think. They have this library full of unused toys to the masses with a load of imagination appeal, and they don't use them. And it's a waste. It's a total and complete waste.
And, you know, we've seen successful spy series. Actually, we see the successful spy movies, but they come from the TV. Actually, Mission Impossible was a TV show. We forget that. Actually, it's so successful as a movie franchise that we forget it was a TV series first from the 60s. So why not have a SHIELD TV series? The Saint was on TV with Roger Moore. That's what got him the James Bond gig to begin with, because he was already a spy in the late 60s. I Spy with Robert Culp and Bill Cosby in the early 60s. We've seen, Maxwell Smart. I mean, I can go on and on. Get Smart, that is. We've seen plenty of excellent executed spy series on TV. Why not have a SHIELD series if you're going to go into this? If you're going down this road, you better do it correctly. And this would be good in the sense of not having to directly need to have Thor and Captain America and Iron Man in the mix. You'd hint at them. So if they're going to do this, they have to do it right. Daily Bugle, Marvel Comics, NYPD, SHIELD, Doctor Strange, you name it, all that stuff should be able to operate on TV. Any thoughts on this, Captain, before we go to a musical break?
Well, I think what the both of you said was well summed up, put together, and I don't have anything else to add to it at this given time.
All right. you can tell the passion. This is not rocket science. I just suspect they're going to mess this up.
I just messed up before.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, listen, I don't know how Marvel operates on TV though. Maybe you know Marvel does it pretty well on the big screen. Maybe they know what they're doing. All right, going into a musical break. Let's take a break. This is a classic. It's Just Begun. Jimmy Castor, the late Jimmy Castor, It's Just Begun. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove.
Gonna make you move.
The oldies and the goodies. Once a game that was the late, great Jimmy Castor. And it's just begun. Definitely a great break record, great hip-hop record. Also, folks, again, you're listening to Afro Nerd of the Comic Shop at the midway point. Going into the Afro Nerd radio show at 7 p.m., we will be interviewing Norman Kelly, Mr. Norman Kelly, author, journalist, several books that we would discuss, several of his books we'll be discussing, centered around hip-hop and politics. This was brought about by Afro Brit, shouting out her Afro Brit from, of course, Great Britain. Upon her suggestions, he said, hey, you know, you guys need to contact some of these people, and we will have this gentleman coming up in about 30, 35 minutes. But now we're, of course, at the Comic Shop, and turning things around a bit, I want to talk about, well, actually, this is dovetailing off of, again, a blog posting at AfroNerd.com by Daryl B, talking about the villain in a movie. What does it take to be a good villain in a movie? And this is coming from the fourthletter.net. Fourthletter.net. Now, before we go into the, I guess, what would comprise a good villain for a movie or for a comic book, actually, I want to talk about a real-life villain. I was just thinking, after picking up this Wednesday's Detective Comics, it looks like they're going to bring back the Joker once again. Now, every couple of years, I mean, because the Joker is so much a Batman villain. He's been so overused. He always comes back. And I don't know. I mean, at some point, I think the Joker should die. How many times can this guy just keep on coming back? Anyway, he's coming back, and for the first time, I looked at the Joker differently. And I'm wondering, when we see the next Batman movie, the reboot, and it's going to be one. They're not going to let go of this franchise, believe me. Just like you're never going to stop seeing James Bond, you will continue to see Batman. I felt weird about it. It's something now, it seems like, you know, this James Holmes, this real-life villain from the Aurora, Colorado shootings, I'm beginning to believe that the Joker may be a real rough villain to go back into. I don't know if we can see him cinematically again. What are your thoughts on this? Daryl, what are your thoughts? Do you think we will see the Joker in some way?
Unfortunately, the thing that this tool has done has tainted a bunch of things related to the Batman mythos, all right? It's tainted joy for some people in going to see the movie. It's tainted the movie itself, because we've all acknowledged that Dark Knight Rises could have made much more. And yes, by him screaming out the remark about the Joker as he did it, that's become like iconic now, unfortunately, when we're discussing that. This guy thought he was the Joker. He even yelled out, I'm better than the Joker, as he gunned people down, you know? So it's almost tainted by association. It's weird to say. And sometimes, you know, I brought up with a friend, the only thing I can remember that are similar to this situation is, if you remember the Twilight Zone, the movie, and they had that helicopter accident that killed a young actress, actor, and the pilot, you know, during shooting. And the news about the crash and the death came out, and as a result, there were people actively campaigning that the movie should not be released, because it's kind of morbid that these actors died shooting it, and it feels like you're making money off of them post-mortem. As a result, there was a lot of people that took it to heart and didn't go and see the movie. They didn't want to touch it. They didn't want to do anything with it. There are going to be some parts of the culture, some parts of the mainstream, that every time Joker is used and stuff, they won't be able to stop themselves but think back to this dang fool. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, you know something, that's an excellent example there, Daryl, because that movie remains an infamy to this day. to this day. You're talking about Vic Moreau. Vic Moreau was a well-known, well-established actor. Very well-known. First of all, the movie itself had some pretty, pretty well-known actors. It really was not like some lowbrow movie, obviously, the Twilight Zone, the movie. It came out in 83. John Lithgow was there. Vic Moreau, Scatman Crothers, Burgess Meredith. Quite a few people were affiliated with it. And John Landis, who was, I mean, he still carries a lot of weight in Hollywood, but Landis has never really, recouped from that. I would say that honestly, John Landis, you know, he gained notoriety from the Michael Jackson Thriller video. I mean, he was the guy to go. I mean, he was up there with Steven Spielberg at one point, as far as like really being the preeminent Hollywood director. And from this incident, the way that it happened, because of his quest for realism, the children were killed, and of course Vic Moreau was killed, well-known actor. And to this day, I think about it. So, you know, if you remember it, I remember it, I'm beginning to think that the Joker, and this guy, he named himself the Joker, has this crazy look, crazy red hair. I think the Joker might be done cinematically. Any thoughts on this, Captain?
Well, time will tell. Time will tell. But I think the next one they're going to go with probably for Batman would probably be the Riddler, which would be perfect for the detective-style Batman if that comes to screen. You understand? Perfect to break down those riddles and everything else. You know, that's the next one I think they're just going to go with. That's just me, you know, but what do I know at the end of the day? Just it happens a lot of times that I'm right, but, you know, what do I know at the end of the day? But I think the situation, the Aurora shootings and everything, that has put a big cloud on the Batman in general, not just Joker, on the Batman in general. And there will always be people. We were talking about this 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. There'll always be people that are going to refer back to this, and rightfully so. Rightfully so. I'm not trying to downplay. I'm not trying to discount the situation. People were killed. It was a serious situation. But time will tell. Time will tell. Joker's a very strong, you know, villain. Very strong. Very strong. And actually, we got to see it when we saw Joker on the screen. We had to see it played out two different ways, you know, with the Keith Ledger and then also the other version that they had. So which were two great performances, you know. So time will tell. Time will definitely tell. But I do feel that you're gonna have to go with somebody else now. You're gonna have to go with something else now. There's a lot of different individuals for Batman to fight, as far as villains are concerned, so you're going to have to go with something else. Back over to you, Sir Affleck.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you on this. It's on the laziness of the suits once again, because the Batman has a rather extensive rogues gallery, as does Superman, actually. And for whatever reason, Hollywood always goes back. They always reboot the villains the same way they reboot the character, the main character. Of course, the main protagonist has to be the same, obviously. But do you have to reboot the same villains when there's so many countless villains that these rogues galleries heroes have? The Black Mask, one could argue, is just as deviant or as the Joker is, and his look is crazy if they were to pursue that. But you know, I have a suspicion that Hollywood is not going to be so high-minded. I think they're going to keep it simple. But I have a difficult time thinking that they might revisit the Joker anytime soon. And, you know, talk about time will tell. Just incidentally, Twilight Zone, the movie, was made almost 30 years ago. This happened in 83. So it goes to show you that this stuff, sometimes when it's so horrific, it resonates with people for a long time. A long time. All right, now, since we're talking about villains, this is, again, coming from Daryl B's latest blog posting at Afternoon.com, and he puts a link out there from David Brother's great site, fourthletter.net, and it's entitled Dark Knight Rises and the Cumulative Villain. And what's his point really here, Daryl, about because he brings out a lot of different villains. I will say this much, after kind of doing a cursory review of what he's saying. The villain is definitely amazingly important. I think we don't really get into how important the villain is in respect to the hero. He mentions Darth Vader, Darth Maul, Bane. I mean, it's a lot of history here with these villains. What is he really saying, though?
Yeah, what Gavok, one of Brother's friends on the site, what he was saying was, if you look at it, and he was comparing Bane to Darth Vader, he was like, okay, if you look at it, both of those guys as villains, you could see how all the other villains in the franchise up to that point, he just used four, five, and six of Star Wars. He sort of glanced over the first three, but then he had to touch it to make the Darth Maul comparison. You know, he said how the final villain in a trilogy is oftentimes a combination of the villains that led up to it. You know, and if you looked at it, Bane had the charisma. And I want to say grandiose style of Ra's al Ghul, and he had the brains of the Joker, you know, and he had the stubbornness of Two-Face. And he said you put those all together, and there you had it. But at the same time, then you hurt Bane by making it all a Talia plot. You know, you hurt him at the same time that you built him up with that. So that led me to thinking, hey, you know what? We all have what we want our villains to be. What villain gets us going? What villain is great for us? All right. Again, another example of it. All right. Usual Suspects. Granted, you didn't know who the villain was, but the last 10 minutes of The Usual Suspects, you know, showed you how a great villain, even not seen, can turn a movie on its side, leave you a lasting memory. And for everything we have said, Bane in this did a couple of things during this movie that will last with people, just like last with people. Hence all the political allusions made to him. Hence everybody, well, I didn't understand what he was saying, but he was badass when he did this. Hence, you know, a good villain will stick with you. A great villain will remain with you. All right? There's a difference between sticking and remaining. Sticking, all right, yeah, I remember that. But if a villain remains with you, then you compare everything the hero does from that point on to what the villain has done. You know, you look at it as like a broken mirror. Here's your hero, here's your villain. My villain, I love him to be intelligent, where he can go par to par with the hero. My villain doesn't always have to be a big, huge, strong guy fighting him. Just think about it. Unbreakable. Samuel Jackson. You know, that was a great villain. You didn't know it at the time, but that was a great villain. It's stuff like that. Everybody's got their own opinion on what their villain's got to be, but to me, that article made you think about what you want to be, what you want to find in a good villain that will keep you enthralled and interested in a story. Back to you, D.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Unbreakable. That came to my mind as well. That was one of those surprise things where you know, at the last moment, literally at the last moment, you found out just how deviant and devious this guy was. And for those listening, the M. Night Shyamalan film? Probably one of his last great films. He had maybe two or three in a row, and Unbreakable came in, and they used the comic book as a metaphor. It definitely was it took place in a comic book store. The villain was a real rabid comic book collector, a high end comic book collector and comic book store owner. Even his comic book store was high end. And at the end, you found out that he was like this reprehensible person. He felt that he needed to be a villain to counter Bruce Willis being the superhero in this thing. And they were supposed to be an Unbreakable too. I mean, I would love for that to be a sequel if they ever decide to get back into that thing. But it was a great movie, and I think that might be an argument as well, Darryl, with Gavick's piece. He's talking about the cumulative effect. Like, he had all these other villains that led to the main villain or were a merger of the main villain. And in the case of Sam Jackson, and you mentioned the other one. There was another one you mentioned, too, where it was a lead-up to the villain.
Yeah, Usual Suspects.
Usual Suspects.
Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey, right. That was another thing where you didn't see that coming. That also has a kind of cumulative effect as well, in a different way. In this sense, it was cumulative in the sense of build-up. Yet it was a accumulation of factors and puzzles that were being pieced together for you to determine who the villain was. In these other vehicles, it was more of actual villains that, personality-wise, they led up to. Even in Star Wars, if you include the prequel and parts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. You know, there's Maul and Count Dooku before you get to
Vader.
Darth Vader. So I mean, it's an excellent argument.
And people don't realize it is much harder. All right, it is much harder to present your villain early, and then have the crowd remain interested in that villain. That's one of the things I appreciate some of these script writers, because if you see the villain early, then you not only find yourself repulsed by some of his actions, but still remain almost magnetically drawn to him as the hero's tracking him down. If your villain is unseen, and you get into build-up, and your hero is going through all of these minor characters, but he doesn't know who the mastermind is, that builds up the suspense. That you, along with your hero, are now, which way is the next attack coming from? How does I know my every move? That's what makes stuff like Sherlock Holmes so good, because you never see the villain interact with the hero until the very end, and it's usually someone the hero met early and just counted to the side, like, all right, yeah, I met you, da da da. And at the end, it was you this entire time. It's that build up. It pulls everybody in. That's why I agree with the captain. If you have the next Batman be a detective story, and you get a chance to build the villain up without Batman ever interacting with him until later on, that could go over like gangbusters. But it just depends on who's writing it.
Speaking of the captain, what are your thoughts on this this cumulative effect on the main villain, or just villains in general, the importance of the villain to these franchises, to these stories?
Well, when you're dealing at the theatrical release level, what the screenwriters a lot of times like to do, what they have a tendency to do, they want to make the villain ruthless. Then, through character development, the villain attains God status. And then, at the end, he's either turned into a wuss or he's totally cut down by the hero. It's somewhat like a formula that they use, even though it doesn't come across to the viewer as a formula, because they know how to layer it very well. So that, in essence, what makes a very good villain at the theatrical level. They have to be ruthless, and then they have to be built up to over a period of time in the movie to God status, and then they're cut down where either they look like a baby or a wuss at the end. As you see there what happened, what went down with Bane, and then you see what happens with Darth Vader. You see it definitely there. You didn't know that Darth Vader had problems with, you know, with the woman and everything else, with the way the whole story over the course of the years of, you know, watching the different films. So that's what they like to do. So that's part of it, what makes, in my opinion, makes a very good villain. When I say God status, God has to take time to build up their energy. So they raise and they go higher and higher, which is actually known as their cumulative effect that they have there in the article. So that's, in essence, the same thing. So it definitely makes sense there, what they're saying in the article, because that's how they do it. That's how the screenwriters do it. And they're very good at it. That's why they get paid the big bucks. The viewer does not really pick up on it at all. But that, in essence, that's exactly what they're doing, though. Back over to you, Sir Anthony.
Before we go to another musical break, just one quick thing I was thinking of. There does seem to be some writers that are trying to flip the notion of the villain somewhat, though. I'm thinking of Mark Miller with Nemesis and Wanted, actually. There are people that are trying to explore the villain from the flip side more also, where sometimes the villain more or less wins out and the hero takes a loss. And according to the natural order of things, or into what we know to be memes or themes, the hero comes in wearing a white hat and is always, at the end, he comes in to save the day. But there are some folks that are trying to challenge that notion. What are your thoughts, Daryl, on what Mark Miller is doing? Especially Nemesis is allegedly has been green-lighted for a film. And that, I guess, the way they propose that is that Nemesis is essentially Batman gone rogue.
Okay,
so there are people trying to do things differently.
All right, but at the same time, as you do this, and this speaks to last week, the hypocrisy that we were hearing, right? When guys go nuts and then start shooting up people and stuff, remember, right? This wasn't the movie's fault, you know? And you're about to propose a movie where an anti-Batman shoots up a lot of cops. That's the simple, shoots up a lot of cops and attacks essentially government establishment. All right, that's essentially the basis for Nemesis. Okay, when this movie comes out, I don't want to hear anything from these pundits and oh my God, it the violence, oh the violence, you know, because listen. It's a very complicated palette that audiences have, all right? And when I saw Usual Suspects, there were people cheering when Kevin Spacey was revealed, all right? But at the same time, in the Avengers movie, when Rocky stands up for the Hulk saying he's a god and everything, and we all saw Hulk's reaction, there's a lot of people cheering that too, you know? It all depends on how they write it. It depends how they write it. A great villain can be just as enthralling as a great hero. Right? It is just how the vehicle is framed. Because there's been a lot of movies where bad guys win in the end, and you find yourself rooting for the bad guys to see how they get away.
Okay,
but at
quickly.
The same time, you know. It's all about quality.
Quickly, let's go to a quick musical break. Speaking of villains, this is The Villain Song by Kirby Crackle. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove.
Every time I build a robot, every time I sink a ship, every time I throw a girl off of a big old building or abandoned bridge, seems you're always there to stop me. I've had enough, I'm sick of it. No more scheming, no more stealing. I think I'm done with all of this. So I took my death ray and put it on the shelf. Cause I found your punches to my face were bad for my health. By the means of act of loud, so be a sum and sum now and sleep with the crap to have fun. Cause I'm done and I'm done. Tried to call, Dr. Hatred told me I was the one that had influenced them all. But I was not return a message till they couldn't take a hint. No more planning, no conniving. I said I'm done with all of this. So I took my dress and put it on the shelf. Cause I found your punches to my face were bad. Watching girls in bikinis, eating crunch berries and Frito-Lays, until I saw you on the TV. Stupid smile all big and bright, the old fire started again burning. Found me itching for a fight and kicking sand into some kid's face. I found my way back home because I missed you. I missed you when I'm so I found my death ray and took it off the shelf. Cause the strength I'm sitting on the beach was bad for my health. Call the minions to fight up loud. Read the atomic sum, feels good, something bad. So watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out, and watch out, watch out, cause I'm back.
We're back with only a few more moments remaining. That was Kirby Crackle, the villain song. Something else I wanted to just touch on, and I mean briefly, obviously it has to be extremely brief. This is from Robot 6 from Comic Book Sources. Once again, another piece that was highlighted by Daryl B. And Daryl B's piece can be seen at AfroNerd.com. Again, AfroNerd.com. This is something we as males have to admit. There was a quote, Daryl, about how women are treated in comic books. And it says roughly that all female characters have a tendency over time to graduate to the field of tough girl with an air of innocence. And also you like to get their pants off. And it says it takes no time for a girl to become 12 to 22 in comic books. Like we see them grown very quickly, very sexualized. What are your thoughts on that? We only have a few moments.
It's absolutely positively true. You know, we just came off a controversy where an artist was criticized by someone at a comic convention for not drawing her characters womanly enough. Okay, define womanly enough. We're always in a hurry to grow characters up. You know, same thing with society. Same thing with we tend to take girls and make them look more adult. You know, make them look like supermodels and stuff. Trying to grow them too fast. And
like Miley Cyrus, right? Like Miley Cyrus, right.
Like Britney Spears. You know, where you force them to grow up at a tremendous rate. And unfortunately, you know, it's art form that's guilty of it is the comic book.
All right. Well, unfortunately, gentlemen, we're going to have to close the comic shop. We'll have to revisit that topic for the next one. I think it's an important one to really dig deep into. Daryl, as always, we appreciate your support. If you like, you can always stop by next door for part two. We're going to be interviewing Norman Kelly, again, Norman Kelly, author, journalist. And we're also, of course, going to be talking about, I guess, toward the 7:30 point, we're going to talk about the Olympian Gabby Douglas's hair issues. Well, she has none, incidentally. There's nothing wrong with the young lady's hair, but something wrong with some of us in our culture. So we will talk about this around 7:30, but we're going next door. So once again, we're going to have to close the shop. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure, and we're going to move next door. Let's go on out with Spock with a beard. See you guys next door.
Spock with a beard?
I think not. Anybody know who Willie Lynch was? Anybody? Raise your hand. No one? He was a vicious slave owner in the West Indies. The slave masters in the colony of Virginia were having trouble controlling their slaves, so they sent for Mr. Lynch to teach them his methods. The word lynching came from his last name. His methods were very simple, but they were diabolical. Keep the slave physically strong, but psychologically weak and dependent on the slave master. Keep the body, take the mind. I and every other professor on this campus are here to help you to find, take back, and keep your righteous mind. Because obviously you have lost it.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man, what is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funk and lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in a cosmos where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a lot of...
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerd Radio, with your guide, Deeper, a.k.a. Afro Nerd.
Good evening, folks. We're back once again, shouting out the comic shop. Now is Afro Nerd Radio time. And speaking of time at 7:01, we're expecting author and journalist Norman Kelly. At the behest of one of our stalwart listeners, Afro Brit, shouting out Afro Brit from the UK. So we're going to speak to this gentleman about hip-hop, R&B, and also about the current state of politics. So it should be quite festive. And after that particular segment, we're going to talk about the elephant in the room, the Olympian, the cute and beauteous and accomplished Gabby Douglas, and unfortunately the controversy surrounding her hair, of all things, folks, of all things. We're back at this foolishness again. Anyway, let's groove a little. This is Ma and Pa by the Mighty Fishbone. We'll be back in a few moments, and you know what to do. Let's groove. Okay, folks, I had to pull out the phaser. That was Ma and Pa, a classic by Fishbone, always giving you the best in urban alternative music. This is Afro-Nerd Radio, and I could not do the show without Captain Kirk. Captain, what's up?
Were trying to take my Caucasian hair hat, but I was able to wrestle it back for them. Now I have it donned, and I'm ready to go.
Oh, Jesus. So you're rocking the actual Captain Kirk's toupee.
There you go.
William Shatner.
That's right. I have on my Caucasian hair hat, the William Shatner version. Nice and blonde. Dirty blonde. He was dirty blonde. I have it on right now. Let's go.
Well, listen, as I said at the top of the show, that at the behest of our friend and listener from the UK, from across the pond, Afro Brit, she was saying that she's been a longtime listener and she likes what we're doing, but she did take a little bit of a critique as to how we talk about the minstrelsy, the minstrel business, the rap music, R&B music and the hip-hop music, how we go about it, that we're not talking about it deeply from the business perspective. And then she mentioned several authors, one of which is Mr. Norman Kelly. Now, Norman Kelly is a rough dude, and I mean that in a good way. If I would definitely implore our listenership to go to YouTube and put in simply Norman Kelly, and he's talking about quite a few things in this YouTube clip. that I find pretty much along the lines how we feel about things. So just to give you a little bit of his bio, I believe this is the gentleman coming through now. Mr. Kelly's a freelance journalist. He's an author. And the two books we're going to discuss with him, these books are still available, by the way, folks. The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, and also R&B, Rhythm and Business, The Political Economy of Black Music. So because of what Afrobrit told us, she said, hey, listen, you guys talk too much about the actual minstrels, the neo-minstrels. Why not talk about the business that hires them? So I said, okay, I'll take you up on your offer. And I decided to contact Mr. Kelly himself. So I believe this is Mr. Kelly. Let me just double check. Mr. Kelly?
Yes.
Welcome to Afro-Nit Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, please, please, please. You're too much.
You're
welcome, sir. You are welcome.
Yes, we contacted you, if you were hearing behind the scenes, a young lady who's been listening to our show for quite a while now. We're always lambasting and critiquing these, what we consider neo-minstrels. Tupac, the late Tupac, but more about Waka Flocka or Snoop Dogg, all these people that seem to show not the very best in us.
Right.
So I did think that we did talk about the business. We do talk about it. But she said, you know what? You need to contact Norman Kelly because of his book. I implore you to contact this person. So I said, okay, let's do our best. Let's try to get this gentleman on.
Being
so
a good journalist, you did.
So I wanted to contact you, and you said you felt that when maybe your books were somewhat dated. They're a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, you know, the minstrel business has been around for over 200 years. So I just think that you might need an addendum to it, but things have pretty much remained the same, I think, since 2004, 2005. Do you think that you need to have an addendum piece on this about what things are like 5 or 6 years ago?
No, not really, to a certain degree. The only thing that has changed is that, like, I'm looking at something on Wikipedia because I know the music industry, like the film industry, is one of the most technologically driven of the arts. So I'm looking at something on Wikipedia. Now, my book came out in 2002, so I'm looking at the major labels on Wikipedia now, okay?
Right.
So major labels, 1998. To 2004. So my book came out between that period. So the Big Five. So these were the Big Five record companies: Warner Music Group, EMI, Sony Music, BMG, Universal Music Group. Okay, now in 2004 to 2008, the Big Four: Warner Music Group, EMI, Sony, BMG, Universal Music Group. Okay, you drop down. 2008 to 2011, the Big Four again: Sony Music Entertainment, EMI Group, Warner Music Group, Universal Music Group. Now we have 2011, 2012. There's only three left: Sony Music Entertainment, Warner Music Group, Universal Music Group. Now, EMI right now is in a process, I think, is being purchased by Universal Music Group. Okay, so basically, in the years since my book first came out, we've gone through two editions, a hardback in 2002, and I believe the paperback version came out in 2006 or 2005. It's now dropped to like three record companies. So the point I'm trying to make is that, like in any business, concentration, monopolization happens. If you're going to look at the artists themselves, you also have to look at the economic context that the artists are performing in. I mean, if there's a lot of minstrelsy going on, it's because minstrelsy sells as a commodity, as a performance art, to the market.
I would definitely agree with you on that. I guess it's indisputable. But what can we do What can we do to try to change things? I mean, it's part of the reason why...
Well, I mean, the only thing you can do, I mean, since it's a market-driven business, the only thing people can do, if people don't like something, they can not buy it. However, you have to organize that, and then that gets to be sort of like problematic. I mean, if people don't like something, they don't have to buy it. The trouble is when you look at sort of like, when you complain about sort of like the Snoop Dogg, one of the things that a lot of people don't realize or don't want to deal with is that the biggest market for hip-hop music, particularly the gangster variant, has been suburban white youth. They have driven that. They have purchased that. And if you're a young black guy, whether you're, you know, middle class or lower class, if you want to have a career within the hip-hop field and you know where, and like I say, it's a market-driven business. You know where the market is. You know what the market is demanding. You are more likely to act like a thug than a nation-conscious rapper. You know what I mean by nation-conscious rapper?
Of course.
Okay. All right. So anyway, that doesn't sell. See, the point I'm trying to make is this. It's always a decision. There's two things that are always going on. The individual artist has to make a decision how he or she is going to conduct him or herself. If you are just in it for the money, and, you know, hip-hop has promoted that, then you're going to do what the money tells you to do, which is you're going to act like, you know, if the biggest selling style is thuggery, you know, and you just want the money, you are more likely apt to go towards that. The flip side is that a black community doesn't have to buy that. However, the other side of that is that there is a larger white community with deeper pockets that will buy that sort of thing. So you have to figure out, who do you approach? Do you get after the record labels and the artists, or do you somehow go around to the white communities and try to get them to, like, look at how they are encouraging this sort of behavior through the purchasing of this kind of music?
Well, I think that, you know, again, your book, I did do a cursory review of your book, and it's quite definitive. It goes through a lot of explanation as to what the business is actually about, who are the major players in the business. I think your book at the time didn't. It was, you know, mostly focused on CD sales. Now there really are no CDs.
Oh yeah, that's been an amazing thing. Yeah,
the physical product is no longer around.
Oh yeah,
There's no more record store to actually go to.
I mean,
so how does that factor in now?
Well, I mean, basically, this is one of the interesting things. I mean, now, because of monopolization and concentration of the market, now, I can't remember where I read this, but right now, those three remaining companies, Sony Music Entertainment, Warner Music Group, and Universal Music Group, they are trying to buy up. I can't remember where I read this, but people should go and check this out. You know, don't accept everything I say at face value. They are trying to buy out all those internet portals in which you can now get music through or from or via. So the thing that has happened is that because of the digitalization of music, now, I mean, this really affected the music, the record industry of years ago. They have hemorrhaged tremendously because a lot of people were, like, you know, just downloading music without paying for it. I mean, like, somebody who, a young person who's 12 years old, he'll say, Buying music? You people used to buy this stuff? And so what has happened recently is that the whole digitalization of music has, as you said, has basically done away with the physical property of music, a CD, a tape, and God forbid, a record, a vinyl record. All that is pretty much passing away. So now what's going on is, like, music is directly made and just, like, shunted through the internet, you know, through various modes of delivery, into your computer, to your home network, entertainment unit, things of that nature. So that has basically really put a hurting on the music industry. So now what they're trying to do, the remaining three, they are trying to figure out ways to buy up all those internet entities that has something to do with pushing music directly from the artist to the consuming public. They are trying to stop that, because one of the things you always have to remember about the record companies is that they are, how do you put it, to some degree, they are less about producers of music and more about distributors of music. That's the big, if you look at my book, R&B, we have a list of the major record companies. In the paperback edition, it was called the Big Five. And underneath each of these headlines, it was AOL, Time Warner, wow, that's ancient, Vivendi, Universal, Burlesman Music Group, EMI Distribution, and Sony Music. If you look at that list, there's all these there are all these labels underneath it. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean they own those labels. What that also meant is that they probably had a joint venture agreement, meaning that the label, using independent label, and using in the hip-hop world, organizations like Def Jam, you know, they were closer to the music. They would spot the artist. They would groom the artist. You know, they would produce the records, you know, or the music. However, they could not distribute it. In the old days, it used to be distributing it to a store or stores. Well, those are pretty much gone. Okay, now the thing is figuring out ways how you distribute the music via the internet directly from the artist to the listener. And now from what I've been reading is that the last remaining big three are trying to figure out ways to, like, buy those avenues up so they can once again be the masters of the universe. And the masters of the universe thing in music is distribution. It's less about production. It's less about grooming new artists. You know, it's more about distribution.
Daryl, I'm sorry. I'm thinking about the last show. Captain, yeah, I'm sure you have a question for Mr. Kelly.
Call me Norman.
Norman. Okay.
Well, you actually, you know, pretty much answered some of this question. But my question was, why haven't, you know, black people taken more of a business orientation aspect related to their music, i.e. owning the music, and instead of just giving their just due for what they really worth?
Well, you know, you did have some elements of that. You had people like Motown. You had Stax. Well, Stax was basically a white organization started by a white brother and sister, and they sold their interest to a black guy. And then you have the Philadelphia Sound, or Gamble and Huff. So you have had those elements of that. I suspect that what happens is that blacks have a tendency to come in a little too late into the game. So by the time they get in, there's a structure, in what I call my book, a structure of stealing already set up. Like, I think I remember I was doing some research about this. And Berry Gordy, if you really go back and look at what Motown was doing during the 70s and 80s, Berry Gordy himself said one day he turned around and he realized that all the distribution networks had been purchased by the major companies. And he was doing things like making movies. I think I read somewhere he was even thinking about making music components. So to some degree, he had kind of taken his eye off the ball. So basically, by that time, what had happened was that people have to also realize that the record industry, as I said before, like the film industry, is probably one of the most technologically driven industries when it comes to the arts. And you really don't have many people really looking into this stuff. I'll give you a case in point. Someone should check this out. I have not done it myself. But I bet you if you look at any major graduate school of business, whether black or white, you should check out the syllabus and see whether they teach anything about the black music industry. I bet you it's not very much. I mean, the hip-hop generation, and I give them credit for this, they've been the ones who have kind of talked about the political economy of black music. You know, they've been very much the ones who kind of talked about, you know, we make the music, but we don't own it. And they have tried to do things like that. But one of the things, once again, like all these, even when you look at any company that Russell Simmons or any of these other hip-hop moguls have made, the thing is they can't independently distribute their own music. At least once upon a time they weren't able to do that. But I think one of the things goes to the fact that it's not taught. I mean, I was trying to do a TV show years ago on a black family that owned a record company for 100 years to kind of look at this issue and put it in a narrative fictional account, you know, with interesting characters. And people didn't want me bond with it because it wasn't about Motown. And that's a reference point. And there were other black record companies called Black Swan years before Motown, just that Motown happened to have been the most successful one at that period. But even that's been swallowed up by one of these last remaining record companies. So I would say basically to answer your question, it's a lack of imagination in historical record keeping. If you don't teach the business community coming up in the graduate schools about the history, doing case studies, then you can't figure out what to look out for and what to avoid or what to do later on.
Okay.
Norman, unfortunately, we have limited time because I realize, you know, there's so many things we could talk to you about. I do want to open up the lines for one moment. There's a caller that's been holding up for a moment. So let's open up the lines. And I do want to ask you just a few questions about your other book, which is quite interesting, The Head Negro in Charge. We have to talk about that before we let you go.
Okay.
Let's open up the lines. Okay, caller, welcome to Afternet Radio. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from, 646. Hello? 646?
So should we just start going talking about the HNIC book?
Yeah, I don't know why. I guess we're not this person. Okay, all right, no problem. Yeah, so you have this book, HNIC.
Yeah, the Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, the Dead End of
Right.
Black Politics.
Now, I read the book, another excellent read, and, you know, one might say you have a bug about Cornel West, as do I, so if you listen to earlier broadcasts, I have a problem with Dr. West as well, but this is another book that might require an addendum. How has your book changed or not changed with the advent of President Barack Obama?
Well, when Obama came on the scene, I was sort of like happy to see him because he wasn't the sort of politician or political I was talking about. The HNIC, your Jesse Jackson, your Al Sharpton, I tend to look at these guys as self-appointed black leaders who come in, they get you all riled up, they collect your votes, they parlay that for their own self-aggrandizement, but they do nothing with it for its policy and improving back, you know, black people's lives or the life of the nation. Obama at least ran, been a state senator, he'd been a federal senator, became president of the United States. I was quite happy to see Obama run because he was doing the opposite of what these guys were doing. However, Obama to me is not an HNIC. I would characterize him as more like a magical Negro, meaning that there was a lot of hope that, you know, particularly within the white community, that he would, you know, once he become president, all the race problems would go away and things of that nature. Depending on what happens in the next 3 months, there's a good possibility that Mr. Obama will not be the chief executive officer of the United States. And I think he's just not been – he's a very intelligent man. There's certain personal qualities that I have that he has that I like. But he may be president of the United States, but – I don't see him as a leader because there are certain things that he allowed the Republicans to do to him that he should have known this was going to happen, and he never set up countermeasures to block that. So now, basically, he's been tarnished, you know, as a failure, despite the fact he has done certain things to put this country on the correct economic path. But the people who he put in and brought with him had their fingers in messing up the economy before because of their policies, and he brought some of these people in. He never once, via the Justice Department, prosecuted any of these people who took down the economy. And that's because, maybe because, he's also gotten millions of dollars from the Wall Street banksters. So I would say he's not an HNIC, but he is what I would call a magical Negro in the sense that there was a lot of hope that people placed upon him, that they thought that once he became president, all these problems would go away, blah, 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 and it didn't happen.
Well, would you say that he might be suffering from what many mayors, you know, when there was a rash of mayors that took over major cities that were men of color, you know, when black men became mayors, that would be a mayor's or even a governor, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
When they get into those fields, in those positions, they become neutered as well. So can't there be an argument that he's no different than what we've seen in the past with some of these mayors?
Well, you also have to look at the fact that, you know, there are when some of these guys became mayors, like, say, during the 70s, people also have to realize that that was the beginning of the deindustrialization of the United States, particularly in urban settings. So a lot of these mayors got saddled with big urban problems, like lack of a tax base, so you couldn't do anything with it to improve people's livelihoods. You definitely couldn't give them any jobs. So to some degree, something kind of similar like that happened with Obama. He took on being president of the United States when the economy was going down the tubes. And with the stimulus, he sort of like, you know, halted the slide, but the stimulus wasn't big enough. Now, as far as being neutered, you know, well, that's why people elect Obama, because, you know, Obama, to a certain degree, is what I call an NTN. He's a non-threatening Negro, which is why I always found it fascinating when you listen to the right try to make him out to be this flame-throwing Muslim socialist, going to kill your mama, blah, 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 blah. I mean, this is a really kind of mild-mannered guy. But if he is neutered, to a certain degree, he has neutered himself.
Captain, any questions for Norman?
Yes. Now, the Asian community, they never actually define their leadership, but of course there's Asian leaders. The white community, there's a lot of white leadership, but they never come out and say this is the white leader.
Because that's a given.
What? Yes. Being,
no.
Okay. All right. Why is it necessary for black people to hold up a leader to God's status? Just expound upon that.
I think it's due to to some degree, it's because that sort of leadership style has been selected by us, and that leadership style has been placed upon us by the dominant power structure. I mean, like, a lot of our leaders came out of like a church-based atmosphere. So you have the alpha male Negro leader who became a preacher, you know, and that kind of leadership style has been very predominant in black America. However, that sort of leadership style is pretty much going away. I mean, those sort of leaders were called once upon a time race men. And, you know, you don't have that, you know, the last vestiges of those are what I call the Asian IC. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, people, Louis Farrakhan. But you have a new generation of people like former Mayor Adrian Fenty, Cory Booker, Patrick Duval, Arthur Davis, and Barack Obama, who, to varying degrees, they don't make big issues about being race or race men. As a matter of fact, there's a book that just came out called The New Black Politician by Andra Gillespie. She basically is looking at Cory Booker, and she makes this argument that these guys basically, what they engage in is something called elite displacement. They use the resources that they acquire, their education, their refinement, and their larger social base as a way to upend the political careers of a Sharp James or someone else.
Yeah, it's something else, too. You go really deep into the black intelligentsia, into black intellectuals, and I've said on many times, whether it's Dr. Dyson or Dr. Cornel West, or even who's the up and comer with MSNBC, the young lady.
Yeah, I know you were speaking to. I can't remember her name offhand. I don't even watch her show.
I don't watch her show either.
Yeah, but I usually tend to refer to them as market intellectuals. They tend to sell you an attitude, but when you look at their work, I'm not that familiar with her work.
Perry.
But when you look at their work, I find it very thin as scholars or intellectuals. I mean, they don't really give you much to think about.
Aren't they edutainers? That's what I call them.
You can look at it that way. I mean, I call them market intellectual. They're just selling an attitude or blackness, you know, or a certain type of blackness to, like, both blacks and whites. You know, you say these things about Cornel West, you know, before some white people, you know, particularly those of the liberal left, and they are as outraged as some black person might might be. And I always keep saying, look at what they write and look at what they're saying, and it's pretty thin. I mean, other people have said this about Cornel West, but you're not supposed to say it in public. I've had whites who said this about Cornel West, but you're not supposed to say it. You know, Adolph Reed, who's somebody who I think is a much deeper thinker than Cornel West, he said this for years. And if you watch Cornel West, I mean, read the latest. There was an issue of the New Yorker, like, I want to be Jesus. I want to be like Jesus. Read that. And West hasn't changed in any way. I mean, he's surprised at the way Obama turned out. I mean, there was three things Obama did before he got elected, which I was saying to myself, wow, he's changing his position on these three things already. This means this guy is a politician, and don't be surprised if he sells you out or he underperforms like all these politicians do. I mean, Obama just happened to be a very good politician who sold himself on his unique background.
One quick thing, because unfortunately I'm going to tell you we're going to have you back.
Well, you know, I would say everybody says that, but it's never happened.
No, well, and when we stick to our words, we will have you back for part two.
Okay.
I do want to ask, because we have to talk about this Gabby Douglas thing, unfortunately. We have to talk about that.
I can talk about that. I mean, I think that to me is a good example of what I talk about in my book, in the HNIC book, how African-American politics and culture, we get locked onto these really stupid symbolic issues that are not about anything.
Well, you know what, Norman? We only got about 20 minutes remaining. Do you want to hang on for the second segment to talk about this?
Sure.
Everyone wants to talk about this.
Sure.
So, first up, let's go to a quick musical break. One thing about our show, just to give you a clue, because we're sick and tired of what's happening in mainstream media, we're trying to do our own thing here with urban alternative music, the music that other folks refuse to play. There are folks, I'm pretty sure, in Brooklyn that you might be aware of that are doing the whole Afropunk thing and black rock thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole other side to black people and black culture that I think should be promoted to balance out the minstrel stuff. But
I'm all for that. I mean, you know, it's just silly that people just get locked into what the authentic Negro or black person is supposed to be. And that's just a very narrow segment, you know,
exactly,
of the black experience around the world, you know.
So we're going to take a quick musical break. When we get back for our second segment, we're going to have Norman back again, Mr. Norman Kelly. And we're going to go into our listening audience. This is Didn't See It. Didn't See It by Sabata. We'll be back in a few moments. Hold on, Norman. We'll be right back. Let's groove.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back. That was Didn't See It by Sabata, shouting out Afropunk.com. Once again, Afropunk.com. We are speaking to author Norman Kelly. And we're segueing actually into another segment that I think everyone wants to talk about, this deal with young Olympian Gabby Douglas. We have to talk about this. Everyone is talking about this. I'm embarrassed, personally. I try not to do the tribal thing. I try not to do the whole brother-sister thing. I go in and out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my DNA, so I do go in and out of tribalism. But this is the time I felt somewhat embarrassed. So, Norman, tell us your thoughts on this. To our listening audience, of course, young Douglas accomplished a great feat. And she finds out that some Negroes are out of control. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, it's a good example of one of the things I was trying to highlight in my HNIC book, that a fair amount of African-American politics and culture is centered on symbolic posturing, on nonsensical symbolic issues. I'll give you a case in point. Okay. Remember, there's a couple of years ago that the NAACP buried the word nigger.
Right.
Yes,
they gave
yes.
it a respectful funeral, and they buried it. And I'm saying to myself, if this word is so odious, why are you giving it a respectful burial? Why don't you just dress it up as an effigy, shoot it in the head, and push it down into the street, throw some lighting fluid on it, and stomp it?
Well, Norman, you can't shoot a zombie.
Yeah, you know.
It's going to come back.
You know. But it's this whole thing about how black people have a tendency to get into these. I mean, the thing about your hair. I mean, we're almost going back to the same stuff from the early 1960s. You know, be concerned. I remember reading about how Cicely Tyson, the actress,
right.
she was gotten after because she appeared in an old 1963-64 television show called East Side, West Side.
She played a secretary, I think.
I beg your pardon?
I remember she played a secretary, I think.
Yeah, secretary, yeah, working for George C. Scott or somebody else, and they were social workers, okay. She was gotten after by the hair police because she wore her hair natural, meaning without process and dye, stuff like that. So now, years later, here we are. We have this young woman who's an Olympian who does some fantastic acrobatic gymnastics, you know. And what are people complaining about? Her hair. Her goddamn hair.
Wow. I want to bring in one of our compatriots from our previous show from the comic shop. We have Daryl B. I know he wanted to stick around to talk about this. Before, we were talking about truly Afro-nerdic things, comic books and fantasy, but he wanted to talk about this hot-button political issue. So let me bring Daryl B. into the fold. Young Mr. Daryl.
Hey, howdy, folks. A great interview. I find myself agreeing with a lot what the gentleman has to say here. It's very interesting. It's very thought-provoking. Unfortunately, we got some members of our race that aren't really deep thinkers, as evidence with what they've done to Miss Gabrielle Douglas. All right? And to her credit, she has kept her head high, and she's responded, well, you know, how am I supposed to see the land if I had my hair did up?
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, I'm quite sure that's one of the reasons why her hair is pinned back, because if her hair is flailing around, it's going to get it's going to block the thing. This is what I mean. They don't even respect her as an athlete.
No, to one of the things he said before, it's completely true. I always reference the Chris Rock. The Chris Rock statement, you know, like him or hate him, Chris Rock has always been able to touch on some things that African Americans, black people, however you want to say, really don't want to touch. He goes, well, you know, going to jail is more respected than the degree, because I've seen cases where guys would come back to the neighborhood, have come back and said, hey, yeah, you went to school, you got a degree, all right, yeah. How smart do you have to be to kick my butt? You know, this is the same thing happening here. You know, Gabby Douglas has done something no other African-American woman has done in winning this gold. Dominique Lawrence came close last Olympics. She came close to doing it, but she didn't pull it off. She
won a gold medal in the all-around. That means you're not just having to deal with one discipline of gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
You got to deal with each discipline and be almost flawless.
I know.
And that's what she did.
I know.
And
I mean,
people are good like her.
You know, it is. I mean, usually I don't get embarrassed, but like, you know, like what Desmond's saying, I mean, yeah, you have a right to be embarrassed about this because it's so petty. It is petty and stupid and superficial.
What you know what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of a whole bunch of comedy routines that are kind of going through my head right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, can you imagine Daniel Hale Williams, who, if I remember correctly, performed the first open heart surgery,
right?
African American. That after he would perform this in today's age, that someone would quickly go to Twitter and say, well, you know, you taking out that heart was okay, but you need to shape up. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? That's
yeah.
what this is. That is what this is the equivalent of. And I tell you, you know, the captain and I, we go to the gym quite frequently. Actually, we went to the gym prior to this broadcast. And we were just thinking about this, as we always do. We put an analytical microscope to this stuff. Yeah, essentially, Douglas was in a gym. You know, if you are in a gym, no one expects you to have some elaborate Mary J. Blige, Nicki Minaj hairdo while performing a physical exertion. No one would expect that. Are we going to expect Michael Phelps to have a crisp hairdo while he's swimming? Really?
No, but you know, Destin, the thing is, if she had had her hair closely cropped, or if she was like bald.
That would have been an issue, too.
Yeah, that would have been an issue, too. You know, there's some beautiful bald-headed women, particularly when they're black. You know, you got a nicely shaped head and it's shine, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's magnificent. But people would have been complaining about that.
You know, there's no pleasing some people, but at the same time, okay? And, again, I find African-Americans do it more than anybody else, okay?
Well, I don't understand why people can't, you know, take comfort in other people's accomplishments. I mean, it's basically, this girl is going to be showing generations of other girls, you can do it too.
Yeah,
if you have a dream, you can do it too.
But you know, it's the hair. The hair is the problem. Never mind she's iconic. Never mind she has done something that no other African-American woman has done. Never mind that Michelle Obama is up in the stands clapping away for her. If Michelle Obama is happy for you on the field of battle, on the field of competition, then I think you should give it a pass.
And people have been talking. I mean, there was something in the Washington Post about it because I'm down here in D.C. And then also there was something, I think, by Allison Samuels on the Daily Beast about it because people are talking. I mean, this is now the stupid thing is like, see, this is the bad thing about the Internet and Twitter and social media. Every stupid thing that used to not get out now becomes grist for conversation and analysis now. So everybody starts talking about it. You know, and maybe that's I don't know whether that's good or bad. No, in some ways I think it's bad because, you know, now we're having this conversation on this stupid thing, but here this woman is not being appreciated for her accomplishments and her athleticism, you know, but it's being talked about because of her hair.
Well, I tell you something. I've been really thinking about this more so than I would like to, than I should. But I'm thinking that maybe this is the part where you know, when you talk about a drug addict has to hit rock bottom in order to elicit correction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always wondering, what is the bottom for black folk and where is the bottom for black folk? We're seeing children, babies, grandmothers being killed by other black folk.
Mm-hmm.
But when Trayvon gets it, we're ready to go to war.
I know. So
the reason why I'm bringing that up is that This thing right here is so much not about Douglas. It's not even about her. It's about all these black folks. And I'm
mm-hmm.
going to on this show we get into issues of categorizing people.
Mm-hmm.
And we use the term lower tier.
Lower
We're talking
tier.
About lower tier black folk
mm-hmm.
that have a cultural. You know, listen. You may not be aware. We have somewhat of a conservative bent on this show. We support Barack Obama, but we have more of a conservative bent. So when you talk about the Cornel West, we countered it with Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams and people like that.
Okay.
So John McWhorter and those people. Mm-hmm. And I think even if some folks don't agree with them, I think they're shut out of the conversation too much. I think if we should hear from everybody, then make a decision.
Well, you know, that's one of my critiques in my HNIC book. Even if you disagree with these people, at least they're talking about substantive things, economics, law, politics, and social policy, which, you know, a lot of these guys kind of, like, don't really talk about. They kind of mention it and pimp off of it, but they don't really have any expertise in it. So, you know, I don't have any problems with, like, black conservatives, per se.
So the reason why I even mention all this is because I think seeing what we've seen, and now, you know, this has crossed over into major media, which is another thing I want to ask you.
Uh-huh.
The fact that now we're seeing people having, I think, Jason Whitlock, the sports columnist, he was on Fox News. And now we're on Fox News having African-American hair, political hair issues, like talking about this insecurity.
Yeah. I mean, it's
a bit much for me.
And I know.
I think that I talk about the blood and the pus that has to come out before a wound heals.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe this is what it is in order for black folks. Because I don't see – first of all, I would like to hear from the voices that had this opinion on Douglas's hair. No one has come out explaining why they are right for their tweet.
Of course they're not going to come out, Desmond, because that's the whole beauty of Twitter and the Internet. You can hide behind your handle and not be accounted for anything. I'm on Twitter. I'm on all that stuff. I'm known as Norman Kelly. I don't hide behind a fake name or anything. I made that decision a long time ago. If I say something, and that keeps me in check, that means I'm not going to say anything stupid. And that's what a lot of people do. The Internet has become a license with stupidity in a lot of ways.
And, Mr. Kelly, that's where everybody in this group that you're talking to, we've all been this way. When we put something out there, we put our names to it, you know. And I, this conversation takes me back. You remember when Chris Rock did his Good Hair
documentary,
right? He appeared on Oprah, and there was a bunch of black ladies on Oprah that attacked him during the show, saying, "This ain't a representation of us. This ain't representation of us. We like this. This will never become an issue." Well, guess what? It's become an issue.
And I bet you some of those people in that audience were the exact same people sending that stuff out. It would not surprise me.
I want to go to a quick clip. This is yours truly on Rob Redding's show. I was on, I was a caller on SiriusXM's Rob Redding where we talked about this issue. So I want to play this quickly. But I want to say one quick thing. One thing that we should note throughout this entire issue, there was nothing wrong with this young lady's hair. First of all, I mean, I was in the gym. The captain and myself, we have a lot of friends of different ethnicities at the gym, and no, when she actually executed her feat and won the medals, and we saw her, and she's a cute little thing. She's very, very lithe, and you know, she's young. No one saw anything. I didn't see anything. Her colleagues, many who are white, they had their hair pulled back because they're performing a athletic maneuver. I mean, this is. I think some of the women who called up, who I suspect are not gym enthusiasts, that's another issue for another show. who I suspect they have never seen a gym. That's an issue. They're saying that some of our black women, not all, but some, refuse to work out, which is a health necessity because of messing up their dues. That's insanity.
I know.
You know, you have high blood pressure, but your dew looks tight. Come on.
See, but this is like a classic example of just like how I have this theory that the United States itself is increasingly becoming a very superficial nation.
Well, you know,
like black folks have beaten the rest of the nation to this, but this is just like par for the course. I mean, like there's a level of superficiality that is running amok in the United States. Americans have never been an overtly intellectual people, but we have not been stupid.
But oh, we're down there now.
Huh?
the bar has been low.
I know. But see, but this is what's going on now. This just like stupidity has just run amok in this country. I mean, you can't even have a conversation between liberals and conservatives without each other calling themselves each other the worst kind of thing. I mean, like, look, we all live in this country. We have different views of policy, but at least we can sit down and have a rational conversation about this. No, we can't do that anymore.
I was going to say one thing before I go to this quick clip. We only have about 5 minutes remaining, unfortunately. Is that I think that these women who made the comments are confusing what she's doing with someone like Beyonce or Mary J. Blige, who's performing performing on stage. You know, maybe you might look at their hair more or their appearance more sharply because they're performing. They're musical artists, but someone who is an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who's the volleyball players, everyone has their hair pulled back. No one's looking for some Milan model.
You can't do your work if you're a female and your hair is flying all over your face.
It makes no sense.
Let
me go to this quick this little quick thing on Rob Redding. This is Rob Redding from SiriusXM and Afro Nerd myself. Hold on one moment.
Okay.
Call making sure this is on here. The president has to defend his wife. He should. Look, I would defend the president. I will catch his back. When he takes their head off, when he puts their finger in the face, I will catch his back on that. 855-ROB-3080, 855-762-3080. Afro Nerd in New York, SiriusXM 128, The Power, you're up.
Rob, how's it going? Listen, I love your show. I love what you're doing. Your voice is very important, extremely important. But one thing I think we have to be honest about, as African Americans, we have currently a working minstrel industry, a minstrel culture. And what I mean by that is years ago, you could defend these things because you had so many stellar black folks out in front, whether it's Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, you name it. You can name it so easily, the type of stalwart black folks you had representing us. Now we literally have neo-minstrelsy representing black folk who will languish over the N-word, who have commodified the N-word. So when we get disrespected, or rather when our president gets disrespected, all that works itself in the mix. I think we're going to have to learn to respect ourselves in order for other people to respect us. We cannot routinely have a culture now that's being promoted that has some folks from the ATL, from your haunting grounds. You have women wearing these Caucasian hair hats. Yes, I said it. Caucasian hair hats. Just manageable
like
women.
Hair hats.
That's what they are. You're showing the world. These women are gluing Caucasian hair to their skull, Rob. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
This is what our culture has created, this minstrel culture. And then you have Kanye and Jay-Z who will say N-words in Paris. It becomes a number one hit. So you confuse people. And anything, you give ammunition to the racist to say, hey, you said it's okay to say it's the N-word. We are.
There's a little bit more, folks, but time is kind of rolling. I kind of put that out there because I was talking about this whole it's related to the hair hats and to the minstrelsy, and I think that the pus and the blood, Captain, have to come out in order for our wounds to heal. So that's my little appearance on the Rob Redding Show on SiriusXM. But
so you're basically saying that we're giving them license to kill?
Pretty much. You can't blame the white folks on this one.
I agree with you. I mean, this stuff has gotten really silly. I mean, this is one of the interesting things I was hoping that when Obama was elected, that you would see the return of those sort of like, you know, black middle class values. I went a couple of years ago. I went to a photography exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery, and it was a photograph exhibition of black folks. And it was just really amazing, like looking at all these black folks who were all suited up, looking very nice, looking very sharp, but they were also taking care of business. That is all gone now because this whole thug thing, you know, and excuse me, expression, but the nigga on the corner has replaced the man or woman going to work every day, trying to raise his or her family.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is.
It's an industry as an aesthetic.
I know.
As a vocation.
Well, the whole pimp thing.
As a
when
vocation.
Did the pimp become
Well, listen, this is what this show is about, Norman. We're trying to
get on it some more.
Just remember, Huey Freeman was right. If you remember the Boondocks, President Obama getting elected episode, Huey Freeman was right. Because everything that was predicted in that by Aaron McGruder has come to pass. We have not become enlightened. We've gotten more stuck in the mud.
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we're going to have to close the shop. We're about remaining. Norman, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I promise you, we'll, I'll call you back because we want to talk part two. There's some questions I didn't even talk about with your HNIC book.
Okay.
So we'll promote your books, and we will, I promise you, give you a call and get you back again. So we appreciate it. Folks, this has been Afternoon Radio, speaking with Norman Kelly. Captain, any closing remarks?
Nice interview. I enjoyed it. Very well done.
Same
okay.
Here.
Absolute pleasure. We're going out on I'm Yours by Prince. We'll see you again on Wednesday. Thanks again.